Tax Liquidating Trust v. Vernock. Mr. McBreen.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm here on behalf of the CDX Liquidating Trust, the Honorable Gino DeVito, and with regard to our basis for the appeal, the three critical things that we believe the district court did wrong was dealt with using proximate cause as a reason to not conduct a fiduciary duty analysis and preventing the jury from conducting a fiduciary duty analysis before the standard had been set as to whether the business judgment rule should apply or entire fairness should apply. Similarly, the district court erred by avoiding and preventing the jury from considering a fiduciary duty analysis in connection with Section 144 of the Delaware General Corporate Law, which deals with related party transactions. And finally, Your Honor, and to a lesser degree, because this wasn't focused on as much by the district court, but we believe that the court avoided and prevented the jury from considering a fiduciary duty analysis because of incorrectly interpreting the scope of the exculpatory provision in the Articles of Incorporation for the company. Going back to my first point dealing with proximate cause, when you look at the parallels between Cinerama and CD2, what happened in our case, it's remarkable. In Cinerama, the chancellor believed that he could avoid making those hard fiduciary duty analysis call because of a case, Barnes, which he had found, which dealt with the same issue of proximate cause. And in that case, the chancellor determined that the plaintiff couldn't meet the burden of proximate cause and therefore took the case away from the jury. And the Delaware Supreme Court, in unequivocal terms, said it was completely inappropriate to do that. And it was against the policy of Delaware. And that instead, before the burden, it was completely inappropriate to use proximate cause and to require the plaintiff to enter proof of proximate cause before the burden shifting analysis had been conducted and the court had determined and the jury determined whether or not the case should be viewed under the business judgment rule or the entire fairness standard.
Mr. McBreen, was there any invitation of if there were error in this case by including the proximate cause instruction?
Well, Your Honor, number one, I don't think so. And when you read the transcript of what the district court said in that regard, it acknowledged that we did have a proximate cause instruction and that the defendants had a proximate cause instruction. In fact, it said that it thought that the proximate cause instruction from the defendants was better, and that's what it was focusing on. But more importantly, Your Honor, we filed a motion at the same time that this whole issue came up of burden shifting and whether it should have been business judgment rule or entire fairness. We filed a motion for a verdict or for a ruling as a matter of law that we had overcome the business judgment rule. So to suggest that we had waived that issue, number one, I just don't see how you get there. And again, we're not saying that proximate cause doesn't have any import ultimately in a case like this, but it doesn't before the burden shifting analysis has to be decided. And clearly, the Delaware Supreme Court agrees with that. Now,
so on your view, the jury would be told that if they decide what there was a breach of fiduciary duty by the defendants, then they have to consider whether the defendants have carried their burden of showing that it was harmless. Is that what it amounts to?
Right, that there was fair process and fair price, which is
that's just another way of saying that even if the defendants were disloyal, if the transactions were as good for the corporation as they would have been if the defendants had been loyal, then there's no harm.
Well, again, Your Honor, the way I look at it is the burden shifts to the defendants to prove fair process and fair price. In this case, when you look at the record...
Look, fair process, fair price, that's just another way of saying that the defendants can exonerate themselves if they can prove that despite their disloyalty, the plaintiff, the corporation, wasn't worse off than it would have been, right?
Something along that line, Your Honor. I think that's probably a fair statement. As I say, in this case, because there was no process, and you can see
there was no what?
There was no fair process. As I say, when you take a look
at isn't that something for the jury to determine?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. This was ultimately, I believe, a jury question. The fact that the court took it away from the jury, I think, is the reason that we're here and the problem. As I say, when you look and just take the simple example of the period from when the Chicago Investor Group first offers the finance in October of 2000. I mean, their initial offer is to, they value the company at $350 million. They're going to be buying stock at $7.50-odd a share, way above what any other prior investor has paid for the stock. Ultimately, because of the communications between Eric Copeland and Charlie Walker, while Charlie Walker wasn't on the board, all of that shifts to the point where Chase now has significantly reduced what it's willing to pay. Eric Copeland pushes the competition away, convinces the board to ignore the offer from the Chicago Investor Group, and the deal that he's backing, the Chase deal, because of the communication he has with Charlie Walker, that price for the stock drops precipitously.
You don't want us to decide that. That's for the jury. Right?
It's not. You're absolutely right, Your Honor. This should have been a jury decision.
A peripheral issue. I understand, you know, your accusations against Copeland and Lyon and others, but how does Venrock itself become a defendant? Because Venrock doesn't owe a duty of loyalty to Caden. So.
I agree, Your Honor, but you have to look at it in terms of, because I think that sometimes the fact that we use the names of the individual directors, it sometimes confuses the issue in terms of what's happening here. And if you look at the very initial term sheet that Venrock submitted to lead the Series A preferred stock offering in January of 2000, that term sheet required that they get a board seat. And so instead of calling him Eric Copeland, in my mind, it's the Venrock director that's occupying that seat. So from the outset, and if you look at their investment memorandum, from the outset, they knew there were going to be follow-on financings for this company, and they put someone on the board to represent their interests, and that they knew they'd be putting him in a conflicted position.
But what is it that Venrock is violating by planting its agent in the board? I mean, it's, you know, nefarious conduct. But I just want what does that violate?
Well, they're aiding and abetting the breach of the fiduciary duty that Eric Copeland commits. Eric Copeland, in the fall of 2000.
So this is aiding and abetting, and this is a concept of Delaware corporation law that you can aid and abet a disloyal. Is liability for aiding and abetting a disloyal director?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
The judge hasn't discussed that at all, has he?
We never got to a fiduciary duty analysis. That's the point. That's all of that should have been considered by the jury. The judge took it away from the jury, and we never got to that point.
And how long had the trial been going on when he interrupted it?
It depends on your count, but it's either 6 or 7 weeks. I think it was 7 weeks.
How much more of the trial would there have been if he hadn't?
Well, we had closed our case, and at the hearing, the defendants had said that they were not going to put on any evidence. So we were on the verge of doing – we were going to be doing closing arguments.
Not any evidence?
That's what they apparently had some issues with one of their experts, and so as a consequence, they were ready to give the case to the jury, and they told the court that.
Okay, isn't it true that all but one of these transactions, the challenge transactions, were voted on by a majority of, or approved by a majority of disinterested directors?
That's a very good point, Your Honor. I was just about to get to that. That's the whole 144 analysis. And the reality is, when the district court handled this, the district court was focused on two things. Did people know that Eric Copeland worked for Venrock? Yes, that had clearly been identified to the other directors. And was there a majority vote in favor of the challenge transactions, despite knowing that Eric worked for the venture capital firm? And that had happened. But if, Your Honor, in terms of the 144 analysis, it doesn't stop there. And that's unfortunately where the district court stopped again. And if I could read Teachers Retirement System of Louisiana versus Adamoff, it's at 900 A. Second 654. The court wrote, the informed approval of a conflicted transaction by an independent board majority remains an important cleansing device under our law and can insulate the resulting decision from fairness review under the appropriate circumstances. For that device to be given credit, however, the board majority must have acted in an informed manner. The conflicted insider gets no credit for bending a curveball past a group of uncurious Georges who fail to take the time to understand the nature of the conflicted transactions at issue. And that's exactly the problem here, Your Honor. When it came to the first bridge loan, Jay Voris admitted he was totally dependent on Eric Copeland in terms of information as to what was being discussed, what was being negotiated, and the import. Same thing with Randy Lyon. He testified that he had no idea what the ramifications would be after the term of the bridge loan ended, and he was dependent on Eric to give him guidance in that effect. Mark Rauschkind, the other director, who didn't even show up for the meeting on the vote on the first bridge, he basically said, oh, when he finally got the term sheet on the eve of the vote, we've got no options, you know. And then he asked a question, are the warrants a dividend on the equity investment? Well, it's not an equity investment. It's a short-term bridge loan. You know, they had no understanding. And that's the fundamental problem here, Your Honor. That's why fiduciary duty analysis needed to occur. I can see that my time...
Why haven't you sued the independent directors?
Your Honor, we made the decision that we did sue the directors that we thought were conflicted and were
disloyal. Right, no, I understand, but the independent directors were not careful. So.
They weren't careful, Your Honor, but they had the protection of the exculpation provision.
Of the
exculpation,
what?
The exculpation provision in the charter prevents them having to pay monetary damages for breaches of duty of care. It does not protect directors from breaches of duty of loyalty. That's why we elected just to sue the directors who we thought were disloyal.
The question is, the independent directors are also major shareholders, weren't they?
The independent directors?
Well,
no. Well,
the directors who were not sued, or the board, apart from the defendants here, they were... Were they big owners?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I mean, Venkata Majeti owned a very significant block of the stock, and as did many of the other founders. And there had been, I forget the exact number, 7.5-8 million raised by the initial founders to get the company off the ground.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. McBrain. Mr. Ramit?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Tom Coons, and I represent Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Your Honor, I represent the individual directors.
I skipped over. Mr. Coons, sorry.
Yes. Your Honor, good morning. My name is Tom Coons, and I represent the individual defendants, as referred to in the briefs below, Eric Copeland, Randy Lyon, Charles Walker, and Stephen Oppenheimer. Your Honor, the trial judges... Rule 50 motion should be affirmed for two separate and discrete reasons. First, as Your Honor pointed out, all but one of the challenged transactions was approved by a majority of the Cadent board, or by a unanimous Cadent board, after all of the alleged interests of my clients were fully disclosed.
That's your 144 argument?
That's 144.
No, look, there's a duty to disclose an interest, a potential conflict. That's fine. That was done. But that doesn't excuse the director from breaching a duty of loyalty.
No, Your Honor. What 144 does is it addresses a transaction. In this case, there were four transactions.
That's not what 144 does. Says that if you disclose your conflict, you're not guilty of, you know, concealing anything from the board, and you can vote on the transaction and do all that. But it's a completely separate issue whether, having disclosed your conflict, you nevertheless behave disloyally. I mean, what if you say, it's one thing, suppose Copeland said to the board, well, I work for Venrock, and I put Venrock's interests ahead of everybody. And so you know, if you let me participate in these transactions, I'll do it for you what I can, but not if it hurts Venrock, right? Now, that's a very different disclosure from just saying I'm a Venrock employee. And then the board said, then the board, you know, makes a judgment. Well, he's a Venrock. He knows a lot. We'd like to have his judgment. He has a conflicting interest, but he also has a duty of loyalty and care to us. So we're going to take a chance that he'll be faithful to his duty and allow him to participate in the transaction. Now, 144 doesn't address that. You know, you have this, what is it called, Benihana of Tokyo case,
yeah,
where it said that about this conflicted director, Abdo, he didn't set the terms of the deals, he didn't deceive the board, he didn't dominate or control the other directors' approval of the transaction. In short, the record does not support the claim that Abdo breached his duty of loyalty. But here, of course, there's evidence, I don't have the jury verdict, but there's evidence that Copeland particularly breached his duty of loyalty, and 144 doesn't address that.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that Section 144 does address it to the extent that the claim...
You show me where 144 does that.
Your Honor, it's in the CD2 case where the court...
No. Look at 144 and tell me where in 144 it dissolves breaches of a duty of loyalty by a director.
It says material facts as to the director's relationship or interest as to a contract transaction are disclosed and are known to the Board of Directors. The Board of Committee in good faith authorizes the contract by an affirmative vote of a majority of the disinterested directors. That, Your Honor,
sure,
if I could just...
Yeah, that's the disclosure. But look, that's the disclosure, and that dissolves the conflict. But if he goes on and is disloyal, otherwise, how do you explain this language that I quoted for you about this fellow Abdo? Right?
Two ways, Your Honor.
And anyway, what sense would it make? You can't have a situation where I disclose a conflict of interest, and then I go and steal from the corporation.
Your Honor, the allegations here are...
You can't have that, right? You'd agree with that. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, the allegations here are conflict and that there was a conflict of interest.
Oh, it's much more than a conflict of interest, because according to the plaintiff's evidence, which the jury hasn't had a chance to consider, this fellow Copeland, you know, conspired with J.P. Morgan or Chase, whatever it was back then, to, you know, offer less money to the corporation, because Copeland says these guys will take less, you know, and J.P. Morgan is thrilled. They're going to be able to, you know, make this deal for less money. That goes far beyond having a potential conflict.
Your Honor, I don't want to delay all my time on a Section 144 analysis because I have an equal independent.
I'll give you plenty of time. Don't worry. But
then, Your Honor, let me just say, 144 is the statute, as Your Honor correctly points out. But that statute has been interpreted.
Yeah, I know. I gave you an interpretation.
But it's also been interpreted by the Delaware Supreme Court in the Seedy case.
It's the Delaware Supreme Court and the Seedy case. I don't see any disagreement with Seed. Seed hurts your other issue a lot. I don't see what it does on this issue.
Well, Your Honor, I'd respectfully submit that with regards to the approval by a majority of disinterested directors, that goes to the conflict allegations. This is not a case where there's an allegations of entrenchment or somehow fraud on the corporation.
Fraud, absolutely fraud.
Actually, the fraud claims were dismissed, Your Honor.
Look, we call it fraud, call it breach of loyalty, breach of fiduciary duty, whatever you want to call it. There is evidence that Copeland helped Chase minimize its investment.
Well, Your Honor, independently...
What do you call that? What do you call that conduct?
I call what Eric Copeland's conduct with regards to anything that happened in 2000 governed by Maryland law. That's what I call it, because that was the law of the corporation in 2000. That's number one.
So you're saying that what I'm describing is Copeland's conduct, which, of course, is for the jury to decide. But if this is a correct characterization, you say that doesn't violate Delaware law?
Well, no, I'm saying, first of all, let's just be clear. In 2000, no dispute, you'll have a reply and rebuttal, Mr. McBreen will concede that Cadent was a Maryland corporation governed by Maryland law. Maryland law...
Right, and that helps you with Lyon. Right, I understand that. Well, we're also, talking about Copeland.
But it also says, Maryland law says, unless there's a claim of improper benefit or active and deliberate dishonesty, there
Well, I think I've described active and deliberate dishonesty.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that the evidence, that Judge Norgel was correct below, that there was simply no evidence of that type of active or deliberate dishonesty. And Judge Norgel was also correct below to find that there was simply overwhelming evidence that there were, if there was any harm to Cadent.
Why didn't he let the jury render a verdict? And then is Mr. McBreen correct that you guys weren't going to put in any evidence?
Your Honor, we had concluded the plaintiff's...
So why didn't he let... You waste 6 or 7 weeks of trial and then grant a Rule 50 motion? What sense does that make?
I think what happened, Your Honor, is that he was the trial court below in Mobbins.
In those situations, they let the jury deliberate. They can always grant, you know, judgment notwithstanding the verdict. But if we reverse, you know, you're back to have another 7 weeks of
Your
trial.
Your Honor, what Judge Norgel held with regards to the issue of proximate cause just couldn't be clear.
Look, I think you're completely all wet on the proximate cause issue because I think the Seed case you mentioned, it's very, very clear. Once you have evidence, once a jury could find that there was a breach of fiduciary duty so that the business judgment rule dissolves, then the burden is on the defendant to show that it was harmless.
Your Honor, we can quarrel about when you show proximate cause.
No, we can't quarrel because it's right in the case here.
Right.
It's not, look, you've got three concepts that come to the same thing here. One is the burden is to show complete, entire fairness. The other way to putting that is to show that the breach of fiduciary duty was harmless because, you know, the transaction was as good as the company would have gotten, and you have evidence of that. And the third would be talking about proximate cause. Say the proximate cause was not the disloyalty of Copeland. It was the collapse of the dot-com bubble. Those amount to the same thing. And the case is clear. That's the burden of the defendant.
Well, Your Honor, at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case, however, the trial judge below felt that there was and ruled that there was overwhelming evidence that any harm to Cadent was a direct cause of the collapse of the tech bubble, not...
No, but there isn't that evidence. There isn't. The record is confused about that because in approximately the time period that poor old Cadent was being, you know, sold for pennies, so to speak. Other of these, you know, manufacturers of this cable modem equipment were being sold at more respectable prices. It's not as if the district judge went through the record carefully and explained why there's absolutely no evidence of harm. It's just a couple of paragraphs, and it doesn't do justice to a very complicated record.
Your Honor, Cadent was sold for $74 million after...
These details, this is for the jury.
Your Honor, the issue of proximate cause is a requirement under any law.
Look, you're not tracking me. Whether you call it proximate cause, entire fairness, harmlessness, it's the same thing. The point is, once you have enough evidence for a jury of a breach of fiduciary duty, then there's a burden on the defendant to show that it didn't matter. Breach of duty didn't matter, didn't have any effect, no consequences. Call that proximate cause. But you have to prove that. It makes perfectly good sense because if you have a breach of fiduciary duty, well, there's sort of a presumption that there's a consequence. Maybe there is no consequence. So they're saying, you know, this burden shifting, you have this employment discrimination. It's not a novelty to shift the burden of proving causation to a defendant.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that at all. All I'm saying is that, number one, Caden, for the ADC transaction and all of the conduct in 2000, is a Maryland corporation. Maryland has very clear statutory limits on lawsuits against directors for any conduct. There is.
Well, we're not talking about that. We're talking about Delaware law about burden shifting.
So
you want to say Delaware law has no relevance to this case?
No, it certainly has relevance for conduct in. Sorry, Your Honor.
You're just going back to your first argument?
It has relevance for conduct in 2001, because that's when Caden was a Delaware corporation. And in 2001, Your Honor, Delaware, Maryland, whomever, require a showing of proximate cause. And as Your Honor
Wait a second. In 2001, what?
The corporations changed.
Yes, I know. And Delaware what?
Delaware law requires a showing of proximate cause.
Well, we're just talking about Delaware law, and we're saying the Seed case, Delaware law, going back to 1993, says that the burden of showing what I'm claiming are synonyms, entire fairness, proximate cause, or harmlessness, or lack of proximate cause or harmlessness, that's Delaware law.
But, Your Honor, the Delaware conduct was approved by a majority of the unanimous Caden board. Our clients didn't vote on those transactions. They did not vote on any of the transactions.
Difference whether they voted or not, if they poisoned the consideration of it by getting these gullible directors to think that Venrock was offering a good deal when it was a bad deal, the fact they didn't vote is totally irrelevant.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that the evidence adduced by the trial...
What a ridiculous proposition you're advancing. You can have someone commit a fraud against the corporation or breach of fiduciary duty. You don't like the word fraud. That's fine. And then you can say, well, if he doesn't vote on the transaction that he's sold these suckers, then he has no liability. How could that be?
I'm saying that if the claim is that he was interested...
Does that make any sense, my proposition?
Your Honor, your proposition would not make any sense, but that's not the case here. The case here is that he was somehow interested because he was...
No, that's the separate question. He disclosed his interest. Then, according to the plaintiffs, he went on and committed this breach of fiduciary duty, which he did not disclose to the suckers, right? He concealed that from them.
Your Honor, respectfully, when the entire board unanimously approves each of the transactions at stake and the board members testify under oath that they were exercising their own independent business judgment at the time, that is sufficient to either block any question of whether it's entire fairness or proximate cause, whatever you want to describe.
They were acting on what they knew, but what they didn't know was that, to take one example, Copeland had conspired with Chase to reduce the amount of money that Chase was willing to invest. And if the directors were deceived by this, the fact that they voted and used their best judgment and so on is completely irrelevant.
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that it simply can't be, the law can't be that when an entire board approves a transaction and there was full disclosure of any conflict of interest, which is what the nature of their claim is. I'm not saying that it absolves the need for any other loyalty analysis. I'm not saying that. There can be other analysis of loyalty, but what was at stake here was the question that he was on both sides of the transaction.
Are you saying they're not charging a breach of loyalty?
I'm saying that they are.
Are you saying they're not charging a breach of loyalty?
I am saying that they are. No, Your Honor. Your Honor.
Are they charging a breach of loyalty?
Yes, as it relates.
And is there evidence of breach of loyalty?
No, there is not, and there is.
That's critical, so we'll see what he has to say.
Well, Your Honor, with regards to the Delaware Corporation, is the law of Delaware, it's the law of Maryland, it's the law of Hemi to your Honor's opinion in Movitz, that you need to show some element of proximate cause. And I realize Your Honor's
question is who has the burden, right?
Right, absolutely, Your Honor.
And an issue in the Movitz case. It's an issue in some employment discrimination case, and seems to be an issue under Delaware law.
Well, Your Honor,
But into this Seed case, which you're not saying is not Delaware law.
Oh, no, it certainly is Delaware law, Delaware Supreme Court.
What do they mean by this?
I think they mean that in the issue of entire fairness, when you get to that stage, you still need to have evidence of proximate cause. You still need to show proximate cause. And in this instance, there was no evidence that the harm to Cadent was caused by anything other than the collapse of the tech market and the failure and the realization of the risks in the PPM. That was the proximate cause of the injury here. The judge said it was overwhelming that that was the cause of the injury, and that's the nature of what's going on here. I mean, Your Honor, it's the suggestion that are my clients or the entities, none of the directors owned any stock, first of all. That's number one, with the exception of Wyan. But the entities they worked for lost $13 million, Your Honor. I mean, the conspiracy to lose $13 million because the company collapsed.
This is for a jury.
Well, Your Honor.
I think. But you may be right.
Your Honor, I'd respectfully submit that under Hemi and under Your Honor's opinions and Mavitz, the notion of direct injury, that the harm to Cadent was directly caused by the conduct of the defendant, simply does not exist here. The harm to Cadent was caused by the collapse of the shares, and whatever the bridge loans did, that's Delaware, 2001, whatever the Aris transaction was, that was not a direct cause of the injury. It was different actions and different people under Justice Roberts' opinion in Hemi and, candidly, Your Honor, under loss causation in Mavitz, as you identify. The entity defendants and the individual directors are not insurers of the shareholders' common investment as you go forward. They're simply not, Your Honor, and Your Honor recognized that in Mavitz. You said the...
Please stop hitting me over the head with Mavitz. Mavitz is a very simple case where the evidence is overwhelming that the fuss that the parties had over the air conditioning system in this building in Texas had nothing to do with the collapse in the value of the building. It was a bubble bursting, and of course you're right. There was a dot-com bubble. It burst. That certainly hurt Cadent. Maybe it did the entire damage to Cadent. I just don't understand why that isn't an issue for the jury. If the district judge had gone through the record and shown no evidence, that might be entirely convincing, but his consideration after this 7-week trial and all this financial stuff and bridge loans and what they do and liquidation preferences, he has a very cursory discussion.
Your Honor, I over my time, I appreciate points on and.
Is Mr. Rummel going to argue?
Rummel's right here.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Kuhn. Sorry to harass you so much, but gave you some extra time. Yeah, so go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Rammelt, and I represent the entity defendants. The trial court below dismissed the conspiracy and the aiding and abetting claims against my clients for two reasons, Your Honors. The first was, without evidence of an underlying breach of fiduciary duty, there could be no conspiracy or aiding and abetting. Secondly, Your Honor, as we provided the district court, there was no, putting that aside, no independent evidence of a conspiracy or of aiding and abetting, any conduct that was in furtherance of a conspiracy or that was in furtherance of an aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty.
The district judge say that? I've forgotten. Did he say that? No evidence of aiding and abetting?
Did he
just base it on the first ground, that there was no underlying breach of fiduciary duty?
No, I believe the court based it on both reasons, Your Honor. Both were argued to the court and both were presented to the court. And at the very end, the last paragraph, the court talks about no evidence having been submitted of any independent conduct. The court had also earlier throughout the trial had actually raised this issue and told the plaintiffs there was no evidence of a conspiracy that had come in, that they hadn't identified any conduct by specific defendants. There had been no evidence of specific meetings, specific communications, anything else. He did that earlier in the case, and I can cite and will cite to the record in just a moment, Your Honor. That would be at pages 2112 to 2115. We believe, Your Honor, in light of the district court's ruling, that the plaintiff's appeal of this issue should be denied for two reasons. The first is quite simply...
I understand. This last paragraph, his opinion that you're referring to, is this 4790, 4791 in the appendix of the appellant's brief? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, the
bottom of 4790?
Yes, the bottom of 4790 carrying over to 4791.
Okay, but again, the court's first paragraph is your first point. The second, and there is an absence of evidence in terms of other individuals that might be associated or affiliated with the corporate defendants. The names are mentioned in passing, so to speak, as to conversations or references, but nothing concrete. What is that about? I don't get that. And then he concludes, so no reasonable jury could find any corporate or institutional defendants liable. I don't get, what's this reference to the other individuals?
Well, I think that the court's last statements at the record that you cited in conjunction with the court's earlier observations during our...
You, what is this talk about? What is the bearing of absence of evidence in terms of other individuals?
I think looking at everything the court had said during the argument, the court was saying there had been no evidence presented to the court of any action by any of the individual specific defendants that would rise to the level of showing that they were assisting in or aiding and abetting a breach of...
You didn't say that.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You didn't say that.
Well, I interpret his language at the end of...
It all you want. It doesn't say it. Isn't this a little cursory?
The court's observations on that?
Isn't this a little cursory?
Well, I think that sentence...
If there were an underlying violation, the question is Venrock and Chase or its other entities, are they liable? This seems to be his only discussion of the issue. I don't even know what it means. Individuals that might be associated or affiliated with the corporate defendants. What's that about?
Well, I think that has to be taken, Your Honor, in connection with his earlier questions during the argument and then his earlier questions during...
Is this a way to decide a case of this magnitude? Which you have the judge makes comments during the trial and you put it together with his oral opinion throwing the case out?
Well,
that seems pretty... casual way of dealing with it.
Well, Your Honor, I think the
it's been dragging on for many years.
I think the court recognized the burden was on the trustee at this point, Your Honor, after 8 years of litigation, to come forward with some evidence that would show conspiracy.
You had a seven-week trial. There is evidence. If there's no evidence with regard to the aiding and abetting, why didn't the judge say there's no evidence?
Your Honor, I think there is no evidence, and the plaintiff's brief makes clear.
Why didn't he say there's no evidence instead of saying that there are no individuals connected with the corporate defendants, whatever that means, since there obviously are individuals connected?
Well, I think right in connection with his earlier observations and the points that were raised during the argument, I think that's what he was holding, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Rammel. So, Mr. McBreen, do you have anything further?
Just addressing the point that you were just raising about this aiding and abetting, and the simple example I can take is at the time that Eric Copeland has that confidential call with Charlie Walker with regard to what's going on the board in terms of the other bid that's in for financing in the fall of 2000, you know, Eric tells them there's financing disorganization and, you know, the bid is suboptimal and, do the best you can, but we're not really that concerned about valuation. These are all things that Charlie Walker very clearly understood to be messages that since Venrock's going to participate on their term sheet, you can lower the price. You don't have to have a high price. Don't worry about the other guys. I'm taking care of their bid. And at the time that Charlie Walker's having this conversation, he's not a director. So Charlie Walker from Chase, a partner at Chase, is aiding and abetting Eric Copeland in the breach of his fiduciary duty. And Eric's doing this because he wants Venrock to participate and get the same advantage of this cheaper finance that, Chase is going to get. And all of this, Your Honor, we believe was evidence of a breach of duty of loyalty, but also aiding and abetting on behalf of Chase and its partner. And the interesting thing is the email that follows that from Shahan Sagikian, who's the head of the West Coast office for, Chase, he says, oh, this is all moving in the right direction. And, Your Honor, what I would suggest is if you look at, I think it's the Paramount versus QVC case. In that case, KKR was doing a leverage buyout with insiders on management. And at one point during the bidding process, the insiders became aware of, the competing bid. And they started to tell the KKR people this. And the guy blew the whistle on himself. He said, hey, guys, you can't tell me this. This is inappropriate. And he literally disclosed it to the people that were running the auction just to say, hey, you know, I don't want this thing later turned over because we participated in a fraud. And that's exactly what they didn't do. That's just one example of what Chase didn't do and why they aided and abetted the breach of duty.
What would you say is the strongest evidence of Copeland offering misleading information?
Well, I think when you look at the email, and I think PX417. That's the one where he's explaining to Venkata Majetti why the term of the bridge loan has been shortened from 150 days down to 90 days and why the drag-along rights are being included. And Eric gives two explanations. Excuse me?
What are drag-along rights?
Basically, it was a requirement because Venkata Majetti was almost 50% or was 50% of the common stock that was outstanding. Each class had to vote in favor of any transaction. And so the drag-along rights require him to vote, as Chase and Venrock dictate, in a merger if they were going to sell the company.
Okay.
And the two bits of information, the two explanations that Eric gives to Venkata Majetti as they're approaching this financing, this bridge loan, is completely misleading. You know, they tell these directors, oh, don't worry about the fact that the term's being shortened. It just means that we're going to get to an equity refinance faster. Well, you know, baloney. You know, it's debt. The gun to the head goes to the head a lot quicker if you can't find your way to refinance the business. And he misleads these guys into believing, oh, this is just a step in the process of getting to the Series B refinance. And the same thing with the drag-along rights. He gives him some pablum about, oh, it's no big deal because we're all going to want, at the appropriate time, we're all going to want to have the business sold for the best price. That's the type of misleading information that Eric Copeland gave to the unsophisticated financially directors. These guys may have been great engineers. They were not financially sophisticated.
Was there any evidence presented as to the financial sophistication of these directors?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. I mean,
to reach the conclusion you have of the lack of sophistication that
they've admitted it. Jay Vora, I mean, he flat out admitted it. He said, I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what these bridge loan terms meant. I didn't understand what the ramifications were. I relied entirely on Eric Copeland's explanation. We didn't have a third-party expert to advise us on these things. I was left with relying on Copeland. That's part of the problem.
That's your best evidence on the first of the bridge loans. Three other transactions here. What's your best evidence of a breach of loyalty distinct from the conflict of interest, which,
sure,
because it was disclosed, is extinguished as a basis of
when
the claim?
You get to the second bridge loan, at least by the time of the second bridge loan, Venkata Majetti is wised up enough that when Charlie Walker comes to him and says, the common stock's about to get hammered, your value's about to go to zero, at least at that point, Venkata wakes up and calls Fred Kopko, my partner, who's a former director, and says, hey, you know, we got to get a competing term sheet on because otherwise the bridge lenders are going to go to the next step and we're about all to get wiped out. And Mr. Kopko, in 48 hours, he was given 48 hours by Charlie Walker to put up an alternative term sheet. And what Mr. Kopko put together in that 48 hours was a term sheet which would put everybody back on a level playing field. The concept was, and it's the same kind of concept that William Blair submitted when they submitted their bid to do an equity finance just before the second bridge. The concept was to get the company away from these bridge loans, have the bridge lenders convert either into preferred stock or common stock, but take the cash emergency away. And the interesting thing is when you look at the various board meetings that lead up to the decision to do the second bridge, again, all of the conflicted directors are the ones who are advising the other directors as to, you know, what's being negotiated, what's the best deal. Ultimately, Eric Copeland tells the other directors, hey, I'm not interested in doing a deal with, like, the COPCO has proposed. You know, why don't you just encourage Worldwide to take their $4 million and put it into our bridge? You know, again, it just seems to me that there was no fair assessment of what was being offered. The insiders controlled the discussion. The insiders controlled the expert information. There was no independent evaluation. All these things were I mean, again, Eric Copeland sat on a number of boards. Nobody else on this board at the time of the second bridge sat on a number of boards. He knew better that in these types of circumstances, you need that type of expertise, that expert advice, especially when there's insiders. Because fundamentally, the insiders, if they really believe in their deal, they want to protect that deal from later court challenge. And that's why you don't want to have a bunch of people getting a curveball thrown past them. I mean, if you're comfortable that it's just like in Benihana, the guy who's the insider, he was more than willing. He offered his terms, but then he stood back. They had an independent committee. They had an independent financial advisor. They encouraged and brought in alternative transactions to weigh against the insider deal. All of that was done in that case. There wasn't any over influence by the insiders in terms of the process. That's why Benihana, you know, you look at the three hallmarks that the court relied on in terms of saying the deal was fair. They said the defendants didn't set the terms. Well, that's absolutely the opposite in our case. Eric Copeland and Charlie Walker decided on the terms of the first bridge loan and ultimately the second bridge loan. That wasn't something that the independent directors decided upon. And you can look to PX 126 and JTX 238 and 239. I mean, they show that these are the guys who were setting the terms. In fact, the directors, the independent directors, didn't even get the term sheet for literally to the eve of the vote. It's ridiculous. In terms of the misleading, again, I mentioned to Judge Flom, PX 417 is that email where Eric misleads Venkat Majetti as to the why they're shortening the term and what the significance of the drag-along rights is.
What was that JTX number?
That was PX 417.
No, no. You mentioned the JTX.
One, the prior one was PX 126 and JTX 238 and JTX 239.
Hey, let me ask you just one final question. Mr. Coons was very emphatic that there's absolutely no evidence that that what went on here had any effect on this on the company. The company was. Its misfortunes were due entirely to the bursting of the dot-com bubble. So is there any evidence that you is related to Judge Flom's question? What is there some piece of good evidence of this?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And I would say just directing you back to that email that Charlie Walker sent his colleagues after he had his confidential conversation with Eric Copeland. And it's not my words. It's Charlie's words. He says, based on what Eric Copeland has told me, we can be a lot more strict. We can be a lot stricter on valuation than I ever thought. And that's the truth. I mean, at the end of the day...
No. But the question is the consequences. So, say, Mr. Coons says the entire responsibility for what happened to Caden was the bursting of the bubble. And is there any evidence that there was
absolutely, Your Honor,
would be better off or the direct or the, you know, trust?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Again, you have to recognize that Cadent was the first of these engineering teams to get that DOCSIS 1.1 certification. Their product, you know, again, it's widely used today. In fact, virtually anybody who's got Comcast in Chicago runs over a Cadent C4. And the bottom line is, they got there first. They had the engineering talent. They'd had the team assembled that made this great achievement. And at the end of the day, they were sold for a fraction of what other companies, other startups, River Delta and Pacific Broadband, Literally, River Delta was sold in July for $300 million. They didn't get the certification until much later. Pacific Broadband, they got sold for $200 million in November of
2001.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. Within months.
When was Cadence sold?
They were sold in December of 2001. The deal closed on January 8th. But Pacific Broadband, they didn't have anything. They had a drawing. They didn't have a design at all that was DOCSIS 1.1 compliant, and they got sold for $200 million.
Now, would you just give me the sequence of those three sales?
Sure. River Delta, well, I can give, there's three of them, actually. BASS, what we call, which was Broadband Access, got sold in October, September of 2000 for $2.25 billion. They got sold to the company that expressed the prior interest in Cadent at the $300 million level that Eric didn't want to do. You know, he recognized it was a huge win, but he, at the minimum, he wanted $500 million. And again, no analysis, no review. It was just blow it off. That was in October of 2000. Then in July of 2000.
Can I just interrupt you? Are you suggesting that Copeland, that's a misleading by Copeland making that assessment of
absolutely.
$500 million?
Absolutely. Your Honor, when the ADC offer came in, it's in his emails, and I can get the numbers if you'd like, but in one of them he says the $300 million offer is a huge achievement for a company at this stage, and we should all be proud of it. But then in his email to the Observer from Chase, he says, hey, but you know, if we just get rid of the CEO, this could still be a good IPO candidate. And when you look at what the Thomas Wiesel, when they submitted their board book, which is, I think, JTX 136, there's a section that shows what these venture capital IPOs go for. I mean, thousands of percent return. I mean, so there was reasons for Eric to have stars in his eyes. But the bottom line is that if you were going to go the route where you have to take this company to IPO, that would mean months and months, if not years.
I don't want to, Judge Folks has been very generous with me. I just want to finish.
In terms of the other two deals? Yeah, the other two deals were River Delta in July of 2001. Got sold for $300 million to Motorola. And then in November of 2001, Pacific Broadband got sold for $200 million to Juniper Networks.
And the Cadence sale is when again?
It closes in December. It's signed up in December of 2001, and it closes in January. And if you go to the Thomas Wiesel fairness opinion,
so
that's where both those deals are referenced.
So where does the Cadence sale fall with the sequence of the other three?
It's a month later than Pacific Broadband. They get a third of the price. And they got the DOCSIS certified product with this wonderful engineering.
So they're aware of that $300 million sale, right?
Oh, sure. Because, again, this is a very small niche.
Right.
All these engineers know each other. And the fact that River Delta gets sold for $300 million in July, I mean, they all know that. Everybody, you know.
Including all these unsophisticated directors.
They know that. They absolutely were aware of what the competition.
Does that heighten their sophistication when they get an offer of, 74?
Not when it comes to analyzing bridge loan terms and the significance and ramifications of the bridge loans and what the exit strategy is going to be when you come up to the end of the term. They didn't have sophistication in that, but they were like anybody else. They're watching the stock market. They're seeing what their competitors are being sold for. And the thing that was so amazing is
saying that the terms of the bridge loan forced them to sell at a.
Absolutely, because
at a low price.
Absolutely,
River Delta didn't have the same.
It was a rolling cash emergency that because it was bridge loans, it had to be repaid within 90 days. Again, for a startup with no revenue, it's like me giving a loan to my 8-year-old. There's no chance he's going to be able to repay it. You know, I can write up all sorts of sophisticated terms. He's not going to understand them. You know, that's exactly what's going on here. They threw a curveball past a bunch of directors.
Okay, well, we'll have to move on. So anyway, thank you very much to both sides for very good arguments. And we'll move on to our...